unpatriotic, or that's the assumption you're making.
And you got to go.
Yeah, thank you very much, John.
Terrific,
and a good
John.
Note to
right.
end on. Well, Otis McKay, we've had a good time here on the air. As part of Pacifica National Radio Dialogue for Peace, welcoming the incredible comments of the web of intelligent folks who listen to Pacifica affiliates.
I want to thank Kathy Partridge and Evan Perkins at KGNU and the other people who made this possible.
And Jackson Allers, engineering there in Houston. And stay tuned now for our next hour.
Sonali Kamatkar.
Sonali Kamatkar, Damu Smith. Joining us from Washington and San Francisco, talking about
Los Angeles. Sonali's
Los Angeles. Sorry about that.
Washington, and we're
great.
Done.
We're done.
Say
good
goodbye,
night.
Kathy. Goodbye, Kathy.
Goodbye, Odie.
Just like
National Dialogue for Peace. It's your financial support of Pacifica that enables us to continue to provide this type of programming. Ensure that the voices of those ignored by the mainstream media have an outlet on these airways. Make your contribution online by going to our secure website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. Or send your checks or money orders to Pacifica Radio at 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009.
Back when Eisenhower was the president, golf courses is where most of his time was spent. So I never really listened to what the president said because in general I believed that the general was politically dead. But he always seemed to know when the muscles were about to be flexed. Because I remember him saying something, mumbling something about a military-industrial complex. Americans no longer fight to keep their shores safe.
You just tell me when you want to come
on. Just keep the jobs going in the arms-making workplace. And then they pretend to be gripped by some sort of political reflex. But all they're doing is paying dues to the military-industrial complex. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. The military and the monetary get together whenever they think it's necessary. They turn our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning planet to a cemetery.
Are they supposed to start?
The military
right?
and the yes. monetary use the media as intermediaries. They are determined to keep the citizens secondary. They make so many decisions that are arbitrary. We're marching behind the commander-in-chief who was standing with our spotlight shaking like a leaf. But the ship of state had landed on an economic reef, so we knew he was going to bring us messages of grief. The military and the monetary were shielded by January and went storming into February. Brought us pot-bellied generals as luminaries. 2 weeks ago, I hadn't heard the sumbitch. Now, all of a sudden, he's legendary. They took the honor and the honorary. They took the dignity from the dignitaries. They took the secrets from the secretary, but they left the bitch an obituary. The military and the monetary from thousands of miles away of Saudi Arabian sanctuary had us all scrambling for our dictionaries because we couldn't understand the fucking vocabulary. Yeah, there was some smart bombs.
You're listening to Pacifica's National Dialogue. My name is Sonali Kulhatkar, joining you from KPFK Radio in Los Angeles. And I believe my co-host, Damu Smith, from WPFW.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Damu.
How you doing?
Doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Well, we want to welcome everyone to this third segment of Pacifica's National Radio Dialogue on Peace. And again, I'm Damu Smith, your host from Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C., and founder and chairman of Black Voices for Peace. And again, we're joined by our co-host, Sonali Kulhatkar, who is host and co-producer of Pacifica Station KPFK's morning show in Los Angeles. In this segment of today's dialogue, we discuss the continuing peace movement in the midst of U.S. military expansionism. Our guests on hand to help inform our discussion tonight are Sam Husseini of the Institute for Public Accuracy, Bill Fletcher, co-chair of United for Peace and Justice and executive director of Transafrica Forum, and Sarah Flanders of International Answer. She joins us by phone from New York City. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
But the most important guests tonight are you, the listeners, and we want to hear from you as we discuss challenges and imperatives for the U.S. and international peace movement. And later in this broadcast, you can join us by calling 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008. Well, Sonali, the Bush doctrine of launching preemptive military strikes against potential and perceived enemies of the United States to, quote, protect the national security interests of the U.S. as part of a unilateralist foreign policy by the world's preeminent superpower has certainly been in full effect over the past weeks and months.
Absolutely. And I think that, of course, the next stop is Syria.
Yes, and the U.S. has attacked and now begun the occupation of Iraq. The U.S. has warned Iran and Syria not to harbor fleeing leaders of the now ousted Iraqi regime of Saddam Hussein. Over the past 72 hours, Bush administration officials have stepped up their threatening warnings directed at Syria, as you mentioned, who they claim has assisted the regime of Saddam Hussein in the war over the past few weeks. Now, the talk about Syria has expanded to discussion about Syria's alleged role in harboring, quote, terrorists and supporting groups such as Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, which recently helped drive Israel's military out of their country. Now, Sonali, in light of U.S. actions in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Middle East in general, as well as U.S. interventionist policies in the Philippines and Colombia and the ongoing crisis on the Korean Peninsula, it seems that the U.S. could be at war without end. And this certainly is a very dangerous period in which we live. And on top of this, we have the development of U.S. warfare state and all that that means, an unprecedented military budget, massive cutbacks in human needs programs, a sweeping assault on civil liberties and civil rights, increased police aggression against activists, and an overall creation of a climate of fear and intimidation orchestrated against anti-war and other activists working for social change. And certainly, Sonali, these and other developments pose great challenges for the peace movement and other democratic forces opposing the current policies of the Bush administration.
Yes, absolutely. I think you're very right in encapsulating that. And I think one of the things that we need to be examining in the anti-war movement is this issue of success. The U.S. government, of course, has promised us that the situation in Afghanistan was a success, that we successfully liberated the Afghan people. The very rapid toppling of the Saddam Hussein regime is also being counted as a success and as a model for then moving on. I think it's up to us here, and I'd like to hear, of course, from our guests, maybe Sam Husseini can reflect on this, is can we, are we up to the challenge of showing, of exposing that the result of our military adventures in Afghanistan and now in Iraq are not in fact successes, that we can look at the deeper consequences and the less covered consequences of our military might and use that to then show that this expansionist ideology and this imperialist ideology is really not going to take us in the right direction, and is really the whole issue of liberation is simply a cover.
Well, I think that it's success by their standards, not their stated goals. Certainly none of their stated goals vis-a-vis weapons of mass destruction, liberation of the Iraqi people in any meaningful way, and so on, that will not be a success. But it'll be a success in terms of, I think, what a lot of people who were very clear-headed about what their actual goals were, domination and control over Iraq's crucial oil reserves, what that will mean for the global economy, the militarization of diplomacy generally globally, and the thrust of what we say goes. So in many ways, I mean, who's to say that imperialism doesn't work? I mean, look at this continent. Look at the legacy of slavery. Look at most of the world that has been colonized and exploited. In many ways, we in the peace movement, I think, have to come to grips with, you know, in some ways it does work. And if it doesn't work, that's largely up to us, up to how we change that. And to, I think we in the peace movement have to be somewhat self-critical in terms of the facts that we present, the language that we use, and our own levels of complicity, and God forbid us, the levels of complicity that are now dangling before the Iraqi people. The Iraqi people are now, I think, in many ways being told, come join us. You'll have a seat at the table. You have wealthy oil under you, and you can, you know, become, you know, you won't be West Germany, but maybe you'll be better off than the rest of the people in the third world. And what that involves is solidarity with them, with the rest of the planet, some of the glimmers of global democracy that we saw on February 15th.
And I think the question is, when you say that imperialism does work, the question should be, who does it work for? Who is really benefiting, and who's benefiting the most? You know, if you look just back at past colonial exploits, say of the British Empire, maybe if you look at it, the British Empire in my home country of India, it wasn't the Indians who benefited more than the British. It was the British Empire that benefited, that sucked the resources out of that country. So yes, imperialism works for the imperialists.
Yes, and that was Sam Husseini speaking initially. I'm going to go to Bill Fletcher, again, co-chair of United for Peace and Justice and executive director of the Trans-Africa Forum. Bill, what's your take, given the context that we are currently operating in terms of what this means in terms of challenges and directions for the U.S. and international peace movement?
Well, you know, Damu, it's interesting. For the first time in my life, we can openly talk about imperialism and not have to look over our shoulders. You know, it's like...
It's progress.
That's right. I'm telling you, the ruling class has basically made it very easy for us to all talk about imperialism because they are talking about it. And that's what I find fascinating. You know, now that the Cold War is over, they've ripped away any veneer about democracy, any of the flowery language. It's about imperialism. It's about empire. And they put a happy face on it, but it's about empire. And I think that we have to talk, building off of the last comments, I think we have to talk about who is gaining and who is losing. I mean, one of the things that's happening on this planet is this incredible polarization of wealth. So within this country, we're seeing it, and on a planetary scale, we are. And it's being reinforced through this militarization. I think we have to talk about that, Damu. I think that the ramifications of that in terms of human services as well as our own humanity are fundamentally at stake.
Sarah Flanders, are you there?
Yes.
Well, International Answer has certainly been one of the groups in the forefront of the anti-war movement and staging protests in Washington and New York and around the country. What do you think is needed right now, Sarah, in terms of what the peace movement must do to challenge this incredible and extraordinary situation we find ourselves in right now?
Well, you know, it's what's so important, I think, is that the global movement has, it's a reality. And it has gone through a transforming leap in consciousness. It's not just all of us speaking who realize this, but the question of empire, imperialism, occupation. The movement itself is being transformed from a movement that called for and pleaded for peace in the millions, to a movement that really is not only able to speak to each other and hear each other and plan actions together, but they really realize they have a common enemy, and an enemy that's standing in the way of all human progress. And we're at a point where it's Bush and the Pentagon who are isolated and hated all over the world and here in the U.S. So it's a transforming moment when I think we have to be much more conscious of that, even as we're raising slogans and planning actions, because it's clear that the empire doesn't work for the people of the world. It works to maximize profit in the most brutal form, but it is unable to provide for the needs of any of the world's people, and unable to provide even here at home. It's more and more into the military budget. that is bankrupting everything. The cities bankrupting this country as a whole and just wrecking havoc on a world scale. What's so important is now it's understood in a way that never was before. And the militancy of this movement, when you think of there have been four international days in the space of 5 months, each time millions of people coming into the streets and coordinated demonstrations involving anywhere from 50 to 100 countries each time in these massive demonstrations. That's important because the media is trying to marginalize all that, say, well, it's unimportant, it didn't stop the war, and so on and so forth. They're going forward with, as was just raised, new, very serious threats against Syria and an absolutely brutal occupation against Iraq, which will truly bring resistance, as occupation always does. So they have an unfinished agenda and one that is rapidly marching forward, and yet there's a world movement that is planning and acting together and that needs a new way of looking at this and slogans that are talking about occupation and talking about empire and imperialism.
Sonali, I'd like to pose this question to all of our guests. Now, let me play devil's advocate here, not that the devil needs an advocate under these circumstances, but you know, people will say, we've put millions of people in the streets here in the United States and all around the world, and Bush went into Iraq anyway. We put, thousands of people called in trying to stop the USA Patriot Act. It was rushed through the Congress. And some people, quite frankly, are saying, my God, this is a hopeless situation. What victories can we indeed claim, given, as many people said, the pundits would say, the successes of the Imperial Empire, the U.S. of America? Bill?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Damu. I think that we have to keep in mind, and many people were unrealistic, it's very difficult to stop a ruling class that is determined to go to war. I mean, it's very easy to pull that trigger the first time and set things off. Anti-war movements have been most successful after the fighting has started as part of a protracted political struggle. So I think that those of us that we all obviously hoped that we could stop the war, but the fact we didn't should not be a reason for despair in the least. The transformation in people's consciousness, the development of a very significant base, I think is clearly a victory. I think what we have to do, though, is be thinking down the road a little bit in terms of how do we actually fight for power? Because ultimately, these demons don't get stopped unless we have power. All the protests in the world will not be enough.
I think that point also needs to be made about the successes. Just to reiterate, there haven't been successes. Just look at Afghanistan. There is chaos outside of Kabul today. Outside of Kabul, the warlords are back in power. They're fighting one another. People are frightened. Women have not been liberated. Schools are being burnt down. But we in the anti-war movement aren't paying attention to the very obvious and clear example of a failure in that country, and what I think is going to be the beginning of a failure in Iraq too. So I think that there is something that we need to be looking at there and constantly exposing that. Also, just to bring up the issue of how to connect up the anti-war movement with other social movements.
But what has been, what Sam and Sarah, to both of you, what would you say have been some of the successes of the movement in the face of what, again, many the average folks see as defeat for the peace movement? This is what we hear.
The brutal success, and it's a harsh one, is I think a clear-eyed look at what just happened. And I'd like to peel through one or two myths, is that most of the institutions have exposed themselves as morally bankrupt. From the presidency to the Congress, the UN sort of did a split. It didn't approve an invasion that violated its charter, but neither has it condemned it, for example. And there's a question of moral legitimacy here. I think we have to be clear, not just as where we're going, but where we've been. I mean, the big myth that I feel even in the peace movement right now is that this was a three-week war. It wasn't. It was at minimum a 13-year war.
Absolutely.
In 1990, we took out the infrastructure of Iraq, we bombed it to smithereens, and then we laid a siege, not to individual cities for a few days. We laid siege to a nation for 12 years. And more people should have been speaking out about that. many people were seduced by, Clinton, who was there for 8 years. And if you look at, Clinton tried to change the policy when he came to office. He tried to change the sanctions policy, and the media pummeled him for that, and he backed off in typical fashion. If he had changed then, if we had exerted a little pressure then, if we'd been sharper on our feet then, we could have saved a hell of a lot of suffering, and not the deaths of what we've seen now, of hundreds of Iraqi civilians, and God knows how many soldiers we've mowed down who are human beings too, let's remember. But the hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis who died over the course of the last 13 years with the sanctions. We have to broaden our understanding of what constitutes suffering, and Bill is absolutely right. It's hard for them to maintain a massive bombing when the cameras are there. We have to shift gears and spotlight things that are often invisible.
Sarah, you want to add to this?
Yes, I really think we have to see what was accomplished in a few months' time of monumental proportions that hasn't happened before, and at the same time realize it's a protracted political struggle. The demonstrations alone couldn't stop the war, but it did absolutely isolate the U.S. military in this war. It was seen by the entire world without any diplomatic cover as a naked war of aggression. And so the military is going into this, what is a long-term occupation of Iraq, and the resistance that it's not going to end. They say it's a quick victory and it's all solved and it's just a matter of weeks. There's tens of thousands of U.S. troops that will be remaining in Iraq. And as we know from the West Bank and Gaza, and as we know from Lebanon, an army of occupation faces long-term resistance. So the movement has to transform itself in terms of talking about occupation and also understand that this isn't the last U.S. war. It's just whetted their appetite. Not a day has passed. They're already talking about and making very extreme threats on Syria in terms of sanctions, military action, making demands. Korea, of course, is right at the top of their list, a whole number of countries. So this movement that's come together needs to stay together, and it is more likely to, because on a global way, people have been through this experience, and they're seeing that it's not just a call for peace. They're really up against the empire itself. And that is a transforming. And I think extremely important at this point.
Should we take listener calls, Damu?
In just a moment, Sonali, let me just let Bill make a quick comment, and then we'll prepare to go to the phones.
Yeah, one thing. Thank you, Damu. I think that in terms of something that Sam was raising, the level of denial that many of us lived through from 1991 until recently, the notion that what was going on in Iraq was almost like a video game war that we could distance ourselves from, has led to a certain kind of disorientation now that the war is over, a certain phase of the war is over, and that there has been a public displays of support that the Saddam Hussein regime is gone. And I think it's important for us in the anti-war movement to not become disoriented by that. The fact that this regime is over, it was obviously a relief to people that it's gone, but we can't allow that fact to move us away from the basic question that this was an illegal war, this was a war against national sovereignty, and that it was up to the people of Iraq to settle accounts with Saddam Hussein. This is the basic message I think we have to keep hammering away, because this use of human rights for imperial objectives will continue to be hung out in front of people.
And I would add very quickly that we have to remind people that this was an unnecessary war, a war rushed by the Bush administration in the face of enormous possibilities for a negotiated solution to this crisis. Many U.S. and Iraqi lives could have been spared had this administration not been hell-bent on regime change, not disarmament, but regime change in Iraq. I'd also like to very quickly say, and we will be going to the phones, that, The media is doing something very silly, but it's sinister at the same time. It's trying to portray, I've heard some commentators say, this was an awesome military victory by our military forces. I'm actually shocked. In 3 weeks they did. My goodness, please give us a break. Here we have the world superpower with the most incredibly technologically advanced and destructive weapons ever assembled on the face of the earth. An army, a navy, marines, everything, cruise missiles. I guess a country with an army two-thirds the size of what it was back in 1991, no match for the United States. So no, Bill Fletcher is right. We cannot see the fact that the U.S. was able to go in as a defeat, but inevitable under the circumstances. What has been a tremendous victory for the peace movement, I believe, is the fact that we were able to produce such massive numbers in the streets. Now our challenge is to transform this movement into a broad-based, multiracial, multi-class, in terms of interest for our movement, into a powerful political movement to compel fundamental social change in the repressive warfare state that has been constructed by this administration. Sonali, I guess we'll be going to the phones now and again. The number is 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. You're listening to Pacifica's National Radio Dialogue on Peace, and we have on our lines as Sam Husseini of the Institute for Public Accuracy, Bill Fletcher, co-chair of United for Peace and Justice and executive director of the Trans-Africa Forum, and Sarah Flanders of International Answer, and in our Los Angeles studio, my co-host, Sonali Kohatkar.
That's Sonali Kohatkar. And
Kohatkar,
Craig,
I'm sorry.
Craig from Tahunga, California, is our first caller. Once again, the number is 1-800-958-9008. Craig, welcome to Pacifica's National Dialogue.
Hello, Sonali.
Hi, Craig. You're on the air.
Hi, okay. Fine dandy. Sonali, I'm a fan of yours. I listen to you on KPFK out here in Los Angeles area. I'm in the eastern San Fernando Valley myself. I'm listening to this by way of streaming audio on KPFT in Houston. I hope everybody's doing okay out there. I was just wondering, what was the likelihood of George W. Bush Walker II being the first American president to be convicted of crimes against humanity in a war trial of some kind?
Well, the International Criminal Court goes into effect, I think, in September. It's not retroactive. That is, any crimes committed before then. But I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens come September, and what will the United States isn't signing on to it, is doing everything it can to diminish the International Criminal Court. And I think that that's something that we need to strengthen. And there are individual countries that are attempting to get people under jurisprudence. Belgium is attempting to indict, or was attempting to indict, Sharon, until the Bush administration signaled to Belgium that that would not be looked upon favorably, and they're backing off. So I think we do need to find the international mechanisms to bring people who I believe are guilty of war crimes to justice.
Isn't it true that the International Criminal Court is something that the U.S. Essentially asked to be exempt from, that no U.S. soldier or no other U.S. serviceman can be tried under the ICC?
Yes, they are, and they always put it in terms of U.S. soldiers who are doing peacekeeping and might do something they shouldn't, da 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 da. But obviously, the major issue is the planners and so on, who, you know, let's be blunt about it, have waged an aggressive war, which is the highest war crime. So they have not signed on to the International Criminal Court and have undermined it, and I think that that's something that we need to put out there in very strong force.
Damu Smith, our next caller is Orlando from Los Angeles, California. Orlando, welcome to Pacifica's National Dialogue.
Thank you very much. Okay, my feeling is we had to face this reality in which we live, you know. A lot of, more than a half of the people, the population in this country, they really don't care about what's going on. We haven't informed them really what's going on. So we have to try to focus our attention on how we can give our voice to these people, because the race is not only for our country now. These warmongers, you know, endanger the whole planet. The whole planet, we're destroying everything, you know, that sustains life in this planet. The biosphere of this planet is being destroyed by these people. So we have to refocus our attention to the majority of these people over here, that everybody is in danger. How we can do this is by calling the people who really know about this situation, you know, about the going the economic, going the in the scientific people who can explain how these people endanger the sustained living on this planet. But we have to do this by increasing our time in the air, that we can explain the people. You know, we have a lot of the time that we use in the station. Is, let's say in the case of Los Angeles, we have KPFK over here, we have a 40% music. You know, doesn't help to inform the people. We have a 50,000 people in the street in Los Angeles, but we have to realize that it's up to 7 million, 15 million in the whole county that can come to this manifestation. So our influence is very little compared to what we had to do. And we are at the point now, if we let these people who speak for planet Earth, you know, who speak for us over here as a country, they really don't represent the humanity. So we have to try to find the people who speak for humanity. We have to go to those people like GPL Lab, you know, those people who can explain many situations, how our planet is in danger, you know, how this whole system of the planet is in danger, so we can pull more people by bringing this truth to these people.
Orlando, thank you very much for your call and comment. Anyone like to respond?
Yeah, this is Bill. I don't think that it's that people don't care, actually. I think that it's easier to accept what we're being told. Because when you challenge the conventional wisdom, it gets dangerous. It's dangerous. You know, I mean, there's consequences that you're going to be charged with not being patriotic. That someone is going to say you're not mainstream. It's much easier to accept the so-called conventional wisdom. And so I think that the what we have to do in part is both education work, certainly, but the building of the movement. What was so beautiful about this anti-war movement is that it allowed for the creation of a community, in the sense that people were no longer by themselves. They weren't harboring their doubts in their living rooms, but they could share those doubts with their neighbors and friends. That's what's so powerful about a movement.
Let's take our next caller from the listening area of KPFT in Houston, Texas. Gary, welcome to Pacifica's National Dialogue.
Yes, I wonder how many of the hosts and guests on the program tonight are familiar with World Radio Network.
Can you repeat that?
World Radio Network. Are you familiar with the World Radio Network?
No, I'm not.
I'm very...
And your question?
Ma'am?
Your comment or question, sir?
Yeah, well, I just, because I think it would be a valuable asset to have, if we had much better access to foreign media.
Media is very important, absolutely.
I suggest that you pay attention to that. You check it out, because the quality is much higher than almost any electronic media that we get here in the United States.
I agree with you. And in fact, so many sources, especially in Britain and other parts of the world, you can actually find English-speaking media, even on the internet if you have access, the Guardian newspaper of London, the Independent. I'm sure my guests and co-host would agree that looking at other foreign media sources can really put a perspective on what's happening in the United States.
Yeah, just to comment on that, because I think we almost lose sight of how the rest of the world is seeing the U.S. government at this point, because the media here so distorts the picture and so packages it with unending lies, even that the war is over, and whether it's sanitary strikes and high-tech weapons and all of that. But the way that the war is seen, of sheer brutality, we don't really grasp unless we just scroll through and look at the way it was covered around the world. And then you really come to grips with the depth of the feeling, and also an understanding that the movement isn't going away.
And I should say, I mean,
the anger is really growing in an enormous way.
Sam Husseini,
we need to take account of.
Yeah, I should say, Sarah, I mean, it's funny how the mainstream media here sometimes acknowledge that, but say, oh, that's how it's perceived over there. Never mind that might be the reality. Never mind that the reality is probably, you know, in many cases far more gruesome than is being covered in the foreign press. So it ends up being a matter of perception when I think it's even worse than that.
And it becomes a big challenge also when you look at what the U.S. military did to the journalists who weren't in bed with the military or embedded. For example, the firing on the killing of Al Jazeera, the surrounding of Abu Dhabi TV, the shooting of the Reuters correspondents at the Palestine Hotel. All of these actions were really an effort to shut down the world media from telling the story.
And yet George Bush is fighting the war in the name of democracy.
Right.
I want to remind all our listeners around the country that the number to call is 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008. And joining us from Los Angeles, California, is Rose. Welcome to Pacifica's National Dialogue, Rose.
Thank you very much. Before the attack on Iraq, there were about 60 wars going on around the world at one time. Simultaneously, 60 wars. And when you look at the history of this country and Great Britain, global fascism has always been the mission. And with those 60 wars and your destruction throughout, the attack on the Middle Eastern countries that we now call Middle East, Iraq and Syria and so forth, are just another piece of the puzzle in their move toward global fascism. Then, of course, they go after Africa, which has naturally been decimated the same as Iraq was decimated during the 12 years of sanctions. Three things as suggestions for the peace movement. One, we take back the public airways. It is the media. It is the media who forms and educates. Naturally, they have not done that. So we should make an effort to take back the public airways, or at least say 20% of all airways must be set aside for the peace movement or something to that effect. Two, citizens don't have to wait for the ICC to deal with Bush and company. What if the ICC never has even been brought up? Three, and the reason why we can't just wait for the ICC is 46% of Congress is Jewish. Now that might sound anti-Semitic to people, but the fact of the matter is Jewish people are pledged to support the nation of Israel. So you naturally are going to have, with 40%, 46% of the Congress being Jewish, plus the Christian right, anything that deals with helping out in that respect is going to pass through Congress. So thank you.
Thank you very much. This is Don Musman. Let me just say that I do think we need to be careful about how we phrase the issue of Jewish support for Israel. Certainly, an overwhelming number of Jews support Israel's right to exist and many of Israel's policies. But at the same time, there are many, many Jews in the United States and inside of Israel, Israelis, who are adamantly opposed to the policies of the Israeli government and its ongoing occupation of Palestine and its brutal, the Israeli government's brutal aggression and brutality against the Palestinian people. I don't know about the numbers that you mentioned, 40% of the Congress been Jewish, but I do think we have to be careful about how we phrase that, because one could perceive that as being anti-Semitic. I think the truth is the truth. The fact of the matter is that there are many Jews at the same time, particularly over the past few years, who have really come into the fold of the movement against Israeli occupation.
Not to mention that all the U.S. presidents to date have been white Christian males. And if you're going to single out any one group, there's one. I think that we can certainly talk about a lot of these issues, but maybe our guests also have something to say about it, Sarah Flanders?
Well, I think it's also important to recognize that the U.S. supports, finances, arms Israel because Israel is an adjunct and supports U.S. policy in the entire region, the control and domination of the entire region. And it's not the other way around. It's not the tail that wags the dog.
Good point.
Real policy comes from Wall Street. It doesn't come from Tel Aviv. It comes from Washington, D.C. and Wall Street. And Israel is supported as a way of carrying out U.S. corporate policy in the entire region.
Let's go to our next caller. I'm quite proud here that our listening area is being represented well in California. Ara from Studio City, California. Welcome to Pacifica's National Dialogue.
Yeah. Hi, Sonali. I am a activist here in L.A., and I just wanted to say, because it seems there seems to be a lot of frustration as far as if we're having any results. And I really think that, you know, we are making progress, and, you know, we've stopped more suffering, obviously, and, you know, they probably would have dragged us on and on and on without us. So I think we need to hang in there, and we can't look for really early results because they're going to, you know, not want us to see that. So I just like everybody know, you know, just to hang in there and that, you know, we are having success. So.
Dumbo, you want to take that?
Well, no, I just want to know, how do you see the success of the peace boom so far?
Well, I think they would have...
And I think there has been, but I'd like to know your views on what you think have been the successes.
Well, just for the fact, I think they would have dragged it on and on, you know, for the obvious reasons. So the fact that, you know, we've stopped any more suffering in that way.
Okay. Well, thank you for your comments.
Thank you, Ara. Let's go to our next caller once more from Southern California, Newport Beach in California. Pat, welcome to Pacifica's National Dialogue. And again, that phone number is 1-800-958-9008. Pat, welcome.
Hi. Yeah, I just, I called last week and I talked to somebody on your station there. And
can you speak up?
I want to make a statement first. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I want to make a statement first. We were told once upon a time, okay, that you do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Correct?
Yes, go ahead.
That was a statement that was made. Okay. Now, the question I want to ask you, I want to ask everybody, do you honestly believe that that was a request? It was a statement of a simple fact. You do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Thank you very much, Pat.
It is a fact.
But who are you referring to when you say that?
I'm referring to
those who've done
everyone.
Unto us.
Who
has done what to us? Be specific.
You do what you do to yourself. You're not doing it to anyone else.
Okay.
It's very easy to figure out who George Bush is. It would be very easy to figure out how to get rid of all of them. The simple fact, when George Bush says, sometimes you got to go to war to have peace, is a simple statement that he's insane. The fact is that he gives it to himself. He thinks that he can find his peace by destroying someone else. And that gives him the peace inside.
Thank you very much, Pat. Thank
you. Peace is of your mind.
Thank you, Pat, from Newport Beach, California. Let's go to Ahmed from Houston, Texas. Welcome to Pacifica's National Dialogue, Ahmed.
Thank you very much. Let me just turn this radio off, please. Thank you very much. It's, you know, interesting what you're talking about. I am an American of Iraqi descent. I've been here 41 years. And really what I am, you know, offended most by is that there are so many, you know, speakers and experts and all that talking about Iraq. I mean, forget the mainstream media. I'm talking even like on Pacifica Radio. And I don't really see many Iraqi at all, or I haven't never heard any Iraqi speaking. And I believe that if you have people from Iraq, they are the ones who are the experts on Iraq, know what's going on, and they're more experts than all the ones you show them here on Pacifica radio station. And yet I've made some attempts, and you know, I believe I could you know, talk and shed light on it, but there's no interest, no invitation, and everybody else wants to speak on behalf of Iraqi and what's going on. And yes, I do not see any Iraqi whatsoever talking, and I can assure you they know about the country more than your entire staff and all the experts that appear on your station.
Is there any Is there any particular thing that you'd like to elucidate? Because I know that I know of at least two Iraqis that have appeared regularly on WPFW, Andy Jalal and Zainab Estrabadi, Imad Khadouri. Is there any particular fact that, as an Iraqi, that you'd like to share with us, or what's your perspective generally? Or
I wanted to really be on a program, but I will give you just one, you know, sample. And believe me,
and I don't fully disagree. Maybe there should have been more. Maybe there should have been more. I don't mean to totally disagree with you, but
well, why don't you invite me to appear one of your programs?
Okay, but you were about to make a point.
I've been here 41 years. I'm a petroleum consultant with over 1 million.
Okay.
Miles around the world. And,
tell us your contribution tonight. You were about to share something. Tell us very quickly because we're running out of time.
See, that's always in every program that I want to.
But tell us your point. We're going to let you talk. Go ahead.
For instance, I'll give you just one example. First I make a comment is that, and then the example that was happening out there. And I firmly believe that there was a fifth column or fourth column, whatever you want to call it, that went along with U.S. military forces. And their job, you know, to go along is for a very specific mission. That is literally to destroy not the infrastructure of the country. All that could be replaced with the power plants and all of that. But really to destroy the culture and history of Iraq of 10,000 years and erase it for in the future from the minds of the people of Iraq who are really, you know, very proud of their history and their accomplishments and all of that. And that has all in the museums of Baghdad and my hometown, the way I'm from Nineveh, and they have been looting and destroying that town too, but there's no reporting from there. And this column has done the job that I believe it goes high up in the administration and possibly all the planners goes back to not just Rumsfeld, but to Wolfowitz and all his, war party, that need to be investigated by international body. I know not KPFT is going to be able to find, Pacifica Radio is not in position to find this out, but one of the main pieces of job, not just the regular history, but really to lay the foundation for one of the greatest civil wars that probably will take place, and believe me, they are doing it right now. And I'll give you one example, is that when this Abdulmajid Al-Khoi from London was flown in by the Pentagon to join Ahmed Chalabi, who is, you all know him, but they landed in southern Iraq, and for him to be one of the main governors there, and he was not really assassinated as Reuters reported. No, he was absolutely killed in front of the whole crowd because they rejected him, and it was right there in front of the tomb of the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad, and that was in Al-Najaf, and they killed him because they rejected anyone planted by the United States government. Today, they are surrounding, with help from the United States and possibly the CIA, possibly the Mossad, surrounding one of the greatest scholars of Islam in that city. His name is Sistani. And now they probably will kill him before he could get out of there. And they're surrounding him, and I can assure you the United States government is engaged in that.
Thank you for this very important information you've provided. I don't know if one of my guests wanted to respond, but
I wanted to comment especially on the looting that's underway, because I really do very much agree. This is not an accident. This is a form of psychological warfare by the U.S. military. It was encouraged. The massive doors of a whole number of buildings were ripped off, as journalists there have reported. There was no roadblocks. People weren't stopped from doing the looting. Instead, they were encouraged, and especially the destruction of the Baghdad Museum, Basra University, Baghdad University. The looting is a form of trying to wipe out the culture and the consciousness of an entire people. It's an effort to break the will, to demoralize the population, and it is also a prelude to a grand looting of the national wealth, privatization, and the corporate theft. But in order to carry that out, the looting for example, of the museum, you can bet all of this will end up in private hands and in U.S. and British museums and collections very, very soon. It was not just crowds rushing in to take whatever they pleased. Simply driving a tank to the door would have stopped it. They refused to do it. They sat by and not just watched it, but encouraged it to happen. Part of the crime, Ed, because this was under U.S. occupation, the United States is responsible for the crime, the looting of really what's 10,000 years of culture.
Absolutely.
Destruction is it's a world crime.
It is. And I just want to add quickly that it's very interesting that when we look at the developments over the past few weeks with U.S. military operations in Iraq, they move very quickly to secure the oil fields.
That's right.
Very quickly. And they did this without hesitation, and they made that a priority. So you're absolutely right. Sonali?
And one of the first locations, of course, in Baghdad that the U.S. forces protected was the Ministry of Oil. Let's go to Mary in Los Angeles. Mary, welcome to Pacifica's National Dialogue. You're on the air.
Thank you. I so much appreciate the opportunity. I was calling to throw out an idea. After 9/11, the people in this country donated hundreds of millions to the victims. And I'm wondering if anybody is taking up any kind of collection for the victims of the U.S. and Iraq.
Did any of our guests want to respond to that? Sam Husseini, Bill Fletcher, Sarah Founders?
Well, I think that that would be, that would seem to be a decent thing. I hope that we put our energies and contributions into making sure that we dismantle the mechanisms of the destruction so that... I mean, there's this image that I think everybody remembers of Saddam Hussein in front of the crowd of the Ba'ath Party and picking out people to be taken outside and shot, old footage of this. And now I think we're in a situation where George Bush before the UN, it looks a lot like that he can signal anybody to go out and be taken out. So I think that would be a very decent thing to, and I'm sure that exists and fairly easy to find on the web, but I think our energy have to be to dismantling the mechanisms that cause massive suffering. And to do so in a really intelligent call. Something that's been sticking in my mind is a previous caller who said that one of our successes is that we didn't let it drag on. And I have a tension as to whether that was a success, because what does not letting it drag on mean? Meaning that they used overwhelming force and took out the infrastructure so the Iraqis gave out more quickly? I have mixed feelings about whether people shouting quagmire, so then they bomb with more cluster bombs to get the thing over with more quickly, is a success or not. I think we need to be somewhat self-critical in that regard.
And also, just as a note to the way in which one can help or send some kind of humanitarian aid, one very activist group that has been doing that and making a political statement is Voices in the Wilderness.
Yes, indeed.
And I encourage people to look that up. I believe their website is vitw.org, Voices in the Wilderness. Let's go to our next caller.
Thank
William
you.
From Woodland Hills, again in California. Welcome to Pacifica's National.
Hi, how are you?
Doing very well.
It's good to absolutely have a part of this caucus. I like to first preface.
Can you speak up, William?
I like to first preface something that was.
We're losing you, William.
Number one, we got to keep reminding ourselves that Bush is only a figurehead. He's representative of corporate America. The White House is now a corporate entity. It's no longer what it were originally drafted as, the as representative of the people. That's not the case. It's the corporate White House, and Bush just happens to be the mascot. Even the corporations that put him there realize that, basically the simpleton way in which he talks is, the religious conviction, that is pretty much and primarily just it's all a part of paying into this big marketing on American expansion, American imperialism. And, this is something that I think most progressives have to keep in mind, that we're not dealing with one entity nor an administration. You're dealing with, as in Noam Chomsky's grand strategy, he points out that it's an overall greater plan that's in effect. And the moment we recognize that, then we could, you have to acknowledge the problem. Once you know what the problem is, then you could start approaching problems with solutions. And I think what we're dealing with, if you were to look at this in the terms of a basketball game, we're worried about the fact that the Lakers lost one game rather than where we are in the entire season. And that's what we have to be concerned with. What's at play? What's the, I heard earlier another caller brought forth that we're dealing with from Puerto Rico. We're dealing with from wars in Africa. We're dealing with, and we all know that if Iraq exported grapes and bananas, I mean, we wouldn't be over there. It's obviously.
Thank you, William. Thank you. We only have a few minutes left, and we'd like to get in as many callers as we possibly can. Would any of the guests like to respond to that? Maybe Bill Fletcher, would you like to comment on that?
Well, yes. Thank you. I think that one of the things that we've done, in part because of his style, is that we've underestimated Bush. I think a lot of people thought this guy was something, you know, just the side of an idiot. And I don't think that that's what we're dealing with. I think we're dealing with a very determined, ideologically driven individual who has a group of people around him that have a vision of a redefined world. And I think that we have to recognize this. This leader of ours clearly has ties with corporate America, but I don't think that, you know, he's like a quarterback that's getting every play called in to him. I think that we're dealing with this ideological force in the White House, and we've got to accept what that means. That they are, in many cases, refusing to let the facts stand in their way of their decisions because they've decided that their ideas are more critical than any kind of reality. I think that that's partly why they did not stop and think about the long-term ramifications, even from their own standpoint, of breaking their alliances with Germany and France.
Damu, we have time for
yes.
one more caller.
And Sonali, I'm beginning to think there's a conspiracy and nobody's called from the East Coast.
I know, and you know, I have to say the next caller is from Southern California too. William from Woodland Hills, California. Welcome to Pacifica's National Dialogue. Hi, William. Walter.
Oh, great. I'm on here. Wonderful. Thank you so very much. I'd like to address something that Kathy Partridge said in last hour segment from Boulder.
You have to do it quickly because we're running out of time.
Pardon me?
We're running out of time, so do it quickly.
She just said something about maybe the war being over. The war is not over, and it just didn't start like a few weeks ago either. The war goes back 12 years, of course, and even before then when Iraq first nationalized this oil from England. The war's going to continue going on. They're going to privatize all the industry there. They're going to start persecuting all those that support the Baathists and academics of any kind. They're going to be pulling people out of their houses by the thousands, killing them and murdering them if they set up a right-wing death squad there. So the war's going to go on. Actually, it's a war of imperialism. You know, the Sirius X, as we know, and other nations around the world. It's a war for national resources.
All right.
It's going to continue. And we all need to know that the war goes on and it's endless until we can build an international movement.
Thank you so much.
Imperialism.
Thank you so much, sir. And Sonali, it'll probably be a good idea to have a last round of quick comments from our guests.
That's right.
Sam Husseini first. 30 seconds.
So something that struck me recently is in the foreign press, people, Islamists in Pakistan are declining to burn the American flag now. They want to burn Bush in effigy. They understand that the United States is not a monolith. We can't let that be an illusion. That has to be a very real, pressing reality. The peace movement disbanded in 1991. It cannot possibly do so now.
Sarah, 30 seconds.
Yes, just to pick up on that, the movement must continue and grow and be stronger, and it absolutely will because Bush isn't pulling back. He's going forward, and it's a global movement now, and that is our greatest source of optimism. We can act together. We should also be aware that the Iraqi resistance is not over, nor is U.S. occupation.
Thank you, Sarah. Bill Fletcher.
Our movement has to take on the question of the occupations, not only of Iraq, but of Palestine. We have to move the issue of Palestine to the forefront. And we also domestically have to fight against increased repression and the deterioration or the destruction of our basic democratic rights.
Folks, we've got to keep the hope moving. We can galvanize this movement. There are conferences coming up in May of many segments of the peace movement. You'll be hearing more about that on the Pacifica stations. And Sonali, I want to thank you for sharing this opportunity with me tonight as co-host of this special Pacifica Radio National Dialogue on Peace. We want to thank KPFA in Berkeley, WBAI in New York, KPFT in Houston, KPFK in Los Angeles, and certainly WPFW here in Washington, D.C.
And Armando Gudino is our producer, Eben Ray, the board operator. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
And thanks, Cedric Franklin, here in Washington, D.C. We want to thank you so much. Good night.
You are listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM.
They came for our lands, our resources. They even patent our genes. Indigenous people have always revered our traditional medicine people, today facing exploitation. What's real here? What's plastic? Find out this Thursday on People of Earth Radio at 11 a.m. here on KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbian, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Belinsky.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
And we're a skeleton crew tonight because Joan and JD are off tonight because of the shortened program. But tonight we're going to be talking about the Bunnies Party, which is happening this Sunday, Sunday afternoon at Fish Plaza downtown, and it's a really, really great party. Besides that, we'll be doing these segments from This Way Out, which includes news wrap and some other great things coming up. But first, we go to London for the BBC News, which is coming to us live.
Accusing it of harboring remnants of the Iraqi regime, carrying out a chemical weapons test, and supporting terrorism. Washington said it might impose economic and diplomatic sanctions if President Bashar al-Assad failed to take what it called the right decisions. The American Secretary of State, Colin Powell, said there was a new situation in the Middle East following the removal of Saddam Hussein. From Washington, here's Rob Watson.
The question being asked by many here in Washington is Syria next? The answer from the Bush administration, neither a clear yes nor a clear no. It's a policy of deliberate ambiguity, designed to frighten Damascus and keep Syrian leaders guessing. Even that most dovish member of the Bush administration, Secretary of State Colin Powell, is joining in the act, warning of possible economic, diplomatic, or other unspecified measures if Damascus doesn't change its ways.
Syria denies having chemical weapons and says it wants good relations with the United States and Britain. Russia has urged the United States to show restraint in its dealings with Syria. Here's our Moscow reporter, Nikolai Gorshkov.
A deputy foreign minister was quoted by Russian media as having said that the coalition allies' harsh statements addressed to Syria may complicate a post-conflict settlement in Iraq. According to Alexander Losyukov, the statements coming from Washington were not conducive to the dialogue between Europe and America on the Middle East conflict, a view shared by France, Russia's ally in the anti-war coalition. The French foreign minister, Dominique de Villepin, has been reported as urging restraint and dialogue while speaking to the press in Luxembourg.
Egypt and Jordan have called for the formation of a new government in Baghdad that will be both credible and representative of all Iraqis. The Egyptian and Jordanian foreign ministers told reporters that such a government would help ensure the full withdrawal of American and British troops from Iraq. The Jordanian foreign minister, Marwan al-Muasher, said the new government should be made up mostly of Iraqis from inside the country and include only a limited number of Iraqi exiles. You're listening to the news from the BBC in London. As American troops consolidate their control of Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's former power base, a United States military spokesman has said the major battles in Iraq are over. Speaking at a Pentagon briefing, Major General Stanley McChrystal said there'd been no coherent defense in Tikrit, but there could be more fighting ahead.
Tikrit was the last area where we anticipated seeing major combat formations, if in fact they were there. There were some sharp fights there, but not a coherent defense. So I think we will move into a phase where it is smaller, albeit sharp fights.
In a further indication that conflict in Iraq has entered a new phase, the United States military has announced that two of the five aircraft carrier battle groups in the region are being sent home this week. The United States is beginning the first formal moves towards establishing a new government in Iraq. They're flying in representatives of exiled Iraqi opposition groups to meet local tribal and religious leaders near the city of Nasiriyah. Chairing the meeting will be the American envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad. He played a similar role in setting up the post-Taliban administration in Afghanistan. However, a BBC correspondent says that the task of creating a post-Saddam government is already posing difficulties. One of the main Shiite Muslim groups in Iraq says it will boycott the meeting in protest at the fact that the American military are running it. Our correspondent says that Iraqi Shiites, who make up some 60% of the Iraqi population, fear that Washington is planning to impose a puppet government in Iraq. The immediate priorities of any new Iraqi government will be to establish security and health care, restore power supplies and get clean water running again. In Baghdad, joint patrols of American troops and Iraqi policemen are already on the street of some districts. Hundreds of Iraqi policemen have responded to calls to resume work. Hospitals and clinics in many areas of the country are without electricity and clean water. In the southern city of Basra, dozens of people are said to have died in the past week because of the lack of drugs and basic hygiene. Haidar Abdul Amir, a senior doctor at the Republic, Basra's oldest and largest hospital, said supplies had run out.
Nothing. They are already dying now. This is a human catastrophe. We can't do nothing. When they came to me to casualties, I just see them and I tell them I can't do nothing to you.
And in other news, a German biotechnology company has begun distributing kits which it said can detect the virus that causes SARS. BBC News.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky, Joan Devlin, and Glenn Holt.
Well, it's one of my most favorite times of the year. It's weather starts to get really nice, and it's been a cold spring here until recently. But Easter, which is Sunday, is better known as the Bunny's Party in my neck of the woods. Trevin Ross is with us. And Trevin, what do you exactly do for the Bunnies? As a volunteer, like everybody is, right?
Right. Everyone in Bunnies is a volunteer. It's an all-volunteer organization. My current position this year is as chairman of the Charities Committee. I'm sorry, not chairman of the Charities Committee. Let me correct that. Chairman of the Contributions Committee, the ones that solicit the underwriting and the donations that help us actually fund the event and put it on. I've also been involved quite a bit with the public relations side, the advertising, things such as this radio show and things like that.
Well, let's go a little bit about the history. Exactly what is the Bunnies Party?
Bunnies on the Bayou, this will be our 24th year, and Bunnies on the Bayou has been around for quite a while, and it started off as just a party thrown by a small group of friends.
In an apartment complex.
In an apartment complex, that's correct. It started off in one apartment complex, and then over the years continued to grow, and at one point was four small apartment complexes, and they kind of strung them all together and used the area there, and the party has just continued to grow over the years, and we are now down at, as you mentioned, down at Fish Plaza at the Wortham Center.
It's my understanding that basically it was just a party in the beginning.
It was.
And the money that they eventually started charging just basically was for the next year's party or just to pay for the expenses.
Well, actually, my understanding of that is initially it was just a party. You know, you just invited your friends and people showed up and there was nothing. In the first days of the AIDS crisis, back in the late 80s, they began charging an admission, which was a bag of food for the students. soup pantry. And actually, there was never money collected until the organization became a charitable organization. So when they first started charging, like I say, admission, that would be that bag of food, they took it over to Stone Soup. And even for a while after they incorporated and became an actual 501(c), they continued to accept food donations up until just a few years ago. So one of the things that we at Bunny's do pride ourselves on is that all of the party is paid for by underwriting before the event occurs. All of the money that is given at the door is donated to charity, and it's always been that way.
That's pretty incredible. So 100% of the money that comes in at the door goes right to charity.
Correct. Correct. Goes directly to beneficiaries that we have selected.
So it from starting as a party to now be a, it has to be run like a business. I mean, it is a party, but all of you people who work within the organization treat it as a business that you try to, you know, it's tough work getting that money to help bring the party together, isn't it?
It is. It's actually, a lot of people, you know, since they only see the one event a year, it takes 8 to 9 months worth of work on a volunteer basis. Once again, everyone's a volunteer to pull this party together. And we have 30 volunteers this year, 30 hosts. And that's about average for us. Sometimes it's a little more, sometimes a little less. But we're separated into several different committees. Each committee is responsible for a certain aspect of the event. And everyone within that committee has a certain amount of work that they need to do.
And pretty much everybody there works that day. Right?
Yes, that is one of the requirements, is that everyone that is a host does work the day of the party. We don't work the entire party, so we get to go have a little fun with everyone else. But everyone does work the day of the party for setup before the event. We'll work some during the party, whether that's door and admissions, and then, of course, afterward to break everything down and haul it away.
What is the party? Exactly what goes on?
Bunny's is a kind of a different event. It's probably the largest outdoor cocktail and social event you'll ever go to. It's a wonderful celebration of the community with an extremely diverse cross-section of people. A lot of the things, you know, that go on are the bonnet contest, where we have a lot of people who show up in some outrageous Easter bonnets and participate in a contest where they can win cash money for the 501(c) of their choice. Even over and above that, there are a lot of people who just show up in fun costumes and just dress up because it's fun. But it's a wonderful day outdoors in the sunshine to socialize with people and listen to great music. We do have a DJ, Dan Metter, who many of you know. He spins for us, and it's just a wonderful time to come out and enjoy the normally beautiful weather that we have.
You've pretty much lucked out over the years, haven't you?
We have lucked out. There was one year, actually I was not a host that year, but there was one year about 4 or 5 years ago where there were just a tiny bit of a rain which passed through. And the people that were there at the time, I believe if I recollect correctly, they said they still had 1,800 people that year.
Wow. Now, you talked about the costumes, but there's also a lot known about the party of the least amount of costumes, I guess.
there are several photographs floating around of people who probably take the less is more approach to their costumes and may show up in a pair of bunny ears and not much else. We have some photographs on our website. I'm not sure what all is there. It's a rather extensive site, which is www.bunnies.org, if anyone wants to go there for further information or party pictures and things like
that.
There's
actually a video on there too, which is pretty neat.
There is a downloadable video on the website. So that's really neat if you've got the right plugins to be able to download that and watch it. That's something that's new this year, actually, for the party.
Where is it exactly?
The party is downtown at the Wortham Center. It's actually at Fish Plaza, which is the plaza out in front and to the side there of the Wortham Center. That's at 501 Texas Avenue. For those of you who've been down to Bayou Place down there, it's just right across the street is where the Wortham is. And then the Alley Theater is across the street on the other side. So it sits right
You can't miss it because a lot of music down there on Easter Sunday.
Exactly. You can't miss the big entrance way that we put up and the banners and all of the people. If you're down there, you'll know what's going on.
And we talked a little bit earlier about this. This is a tough year for charities.
It is. It is. It's been a very tough year. And I will be honest, we at Bunny's have been incredibly fortunate. Our underwriting has gone very well. We have our donations are larger than they have been at any time since I have been at Bunny's, which this is my fourth year. However, on the flip side of that, our applications are, I think, approximately triple what they were last year. So we have a lot of applications and a lot of requests for funding. So while, like I say, we've been fortunate, we've received a whole lot more requests than we have in the past.
So you basically choose charities from looking at the applications that they put in to fund. And what are some of them? I mean, you can get a complete list on the website, I know, but what are some of them that you... That you know, and I guess what you guys do is you also look at the fact that some of these organizations might not be able to get funds other places.
Right. One of the things that we have always held forth as a very strong criteria is that they are local charities. And one of the things that we do is on the application, the money must be tied to a specific project. So these are project-based grants that we're giving, not just for general administrative expenses or things like that. So if they say, here is specifically what we're going to do, particularly this year, we're giving money to HATCH, which is Houston Area Teen Coalition of Homosexuals, the Montrose Clinic, the Center for AIDS Hope and Remembrance Project, Assist Hers and Cult 45s are both on the list, and they've been on the list regularly. Normally, every year we pick new charities, and some groups make it on the list fairly regularly, and some are new. Also, looking at funding Q Patrol and the American Red Cross Teen HIV Education Program. So all of our donations are given to various projects focus on the community, not necessarily HIV and AIDS, but definitely on the community. Things like educational programs or like HATCH, which provides an opportunity for those individuals to socialize with other people.
Now, this party, there's women there, but it's mostly men, and is it a wide variety of people that show up there? Is there a certain group there? Or?
It's definitely a wide variety of people that are there. As you say, it is mostly men, but interestingly enough, it runs the spectrum of the community. You know, you have to be 21 to get in, so I'll say that. But beyond that, you know, we have people that are retired that are there. We have people that, you know, have just hit their 21st birthday that are there. And it's an extremely wide spectrum of all ages and colors and professions. And it's just, as I say, it's really a celebration of community because it is such a cross-section
Yes.
of people.
Are you still looking for volunteers?
Actually, this year, I believe that we are fairly close to filling
Great.
Our volunteer list. If someone wishes to volunteer, they can go hit the website. The last report from our volunteer committee was that they were almost full. One of the things that I know that the volunteer committee does, even though I've never served on that committee, is there always, you know, a certain percentage of people that may not make it. And so there's always a certain percentage of perhaps backup that's needed. So I would encourage people to go hit the website for a wide variety of reasons, everything from volunteering to information to
There's even a countdown else. Clock there.
There is. Yes. There is. We have a programmed countdown clock to the minute. Actually, I think it may even carry it down to the second as to when the party begins. So
Right. Well, Trevin Ross has been with us, I think, 3 years now in a row.
Four. I believe.
Okay.
Yeah, this is my fourth year. I did this my first year.
Great.
First year, they baptism by fire. They said, here, you're going to go talk to Jack Valinsky.
Yeah,
and
they
I was
warned
like, who
you.
Is Jack Valinsky?
Well, great. The party is this Sunday. And what's the time frame?
2 o'clock to 7 o'clock, 2 to 7 p.m. at the Worthy
and
Center.
And it's usually a wonderful party. In fact, it's always a wonderful party. It's a great way to meet your old friends or make new friends, maybe just friend for that night. Who knows? But it's Easter Sunday, and so what's the address?
It's 501 Tex Avenue, I believe, is technically the address of the Wortham Center.
It's right around the corner. It's part of the park around the side of the Wortham Center along the bayou there. So it's a really, really great time. And probably the best way to get some more information is go to the website, which is bunnies.org.
Correct.
Thank you, Trevin. You're listening to Queer Voices.
I'm Dean Elzinga.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian community for the week ending April 12th, 2003. High school and college students across the U.S. and beyond this week observed the 7th annual National Day of Silence to raise awareness of harassment and discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender students. Observances on some 2,000 campuses were believed to involve a total of more than 200,000 students, making this year's the biggest yet. Participants vowed to remain silent for 9 hours, including the school day, making their point by distributing cards with statistics on campus homophobia that read, "My deliberate silence echoes that silence which is caused by harassment, prejudice, and discrimination. I believe that ending the silence is the first step towards fighting these injustices. Think about the voices you are not hearing today. What are you going to do to end the silence?" Many campuses also held rallies, marches, and educational events, with some making the day part of annual pride celebrations.
Conservative protests by parents and students were also stepped up. One California school district told teachers that students observing the day of silence must respond if called on in class, and an Alabama principal prohibited students from passing out the cards based on a rule against distributing political, religious, or issue-driven literature on campus. And sadly, a 16-year-old girl in Concord, Massachusetts, was found beaten unconscious near her home the day after she participated in a Day of Silence assembly and was harassed with homophobic epithets for doing so.
Day of Silence activities were widely covered by media. Proclamations of the day were issued by politicians, including California Governor Gray Davis, Connecticut Governor John Rowland, and Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm.
A panel of the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled unanimously this week that public school administrators can be held liable if they fail to act effectively against homophobic harassment of students. Although the case in question involved a California school district, the appellate court's findings also apply in 8 other western states. 1 male and 5 female students alleged that they experienced severe harassment and some violence over a 7-year period in the 1990s at a junior high school and a high school in the Northern California town of Morgan Hill. When they notified school officials, they were brushed off, except in the case of a gang bashing for which only one assailant was punished. The school district argued that its anti-discrimination policy should shield it from lawsuits. But the 3 judges said that officials could be held liable for having failed to effectively enforce it, thereby violating the student's constitutional right to equal treatment under the law. This means the student's lawsuit against the school district can proceed in federal court.
The El Paso, Texas City Council voted unanimously this week to add both sexual orientation and gender identity to the categories protected by the city's civil rights ordinance. The ordinance prohibits discrimination within the city limits in any of the accommodations, advantages, facilities, or services offered to the general public, whether by individuals, associations, or corporations.
In a still bigger U.S. advance against discrimination, New Mexico's Governor Bill Richardson this week signed into law both a civil rights bill and a hate crimes bill that include both gender identity and sexual orientation. The civil rights bill prohibits discrimination in employment, housing, credit, public accommodations, and union membership. It makes New Mexico only the 14th of the 50 U.S. states to protect gays and lesbians from discrimination, and only the 3rd to protect transgenders. The hate crimes bill makes New Mexico the 28th state to increase penalties for crimes motivated by homophobia and the 6th to do so for bias based on gender identity. Both new laws go into effect on July 1st. At the signing ceremony, before a cheering, weeping crowd of activists who had lobbied long and hard for the new laws, Richardson announced he was also doing by executive order something he was unable to find support for in the legislature.
I am today signing an executive order that will require state government to provide domestic partners of state employees the benefits now reserved and available only for spouse partners. By signing this order, domestic partners will now have access to affordable health care. This is, by the way, a promise that I made and that you didn't ask me to keep.
In a first for Costa Rica, late last month, a government agency granted a trans woman provisional custody of a child, the first step towards legal adoption. The trans woman, known as Mairena, has cared for the 9-year-old boy since he was a baby, and as Pani, the National Infancy Patronage, wrote, provided him food, care, upbringing, education, assistance, recreation, health, clothing, lodging, love, and attended to his other needs that today are considered as rights, fulfilling the role of a good parent. The Costa Rican lesbian and gay group, CPAC-DDHH, views the Pani ruling as an expansion of the definition of family that will advance legal recognition of same-gender couples.
Britain's highest court, the Law Lords, this week rejected a trans woman's bid for legal recognition of her 22-year marriage to a man. Elizabeth Bellinger was married to her husband Michael by a registrar who didn't question her gender, but two lower courts had previously declared the marriage invalid. Like those courts, the Law Lords expressed great sympathy towards Bellinger, and one declared that the couple deserves our respect and admiration. But they ruled that current British law neither recognizes sex change nor allows for any but heterosexual marriage, and said it is up to the Parliament rather than the courts to change that. Bellinger is expected to appeal to the European courts, which have already found that Britain's treatment of transsexuals violates the European Convention, something the Law Lords acknowledged. Britain's government has been drafting new legislation on transsexuals for some time, but it's not known when that will be introduced.
The European Parliament this week adopted a non-binding resolution calling on European Union member states to broaden the terms of family reunification. Included in the expansion are unmarried partners and registered partners, if the host nation already extends legal recognition to such couples. The resolution applies to individuals who are residents in, but not citizens of, an EU member nation, allowing them to bring family members to join them in the EU.
The European Parliament this week also adopted a resolution calling on Egypt to end its persecution of gay men. The resolution specifically calls for an immediate end to all criminal prosecutions based on homosexuality, which in the last 2 years have already resulted in dozens of convictions and possibly hundreds of detentions. The resolution also reminds Egypt of a treaty obligation to protect human rights and calls on Egypt to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation.
Arguments were heard this week in Australia's highest court as two gay men seek asylum from persecution in their native Bangladesh. Both Australia's Refugee Review Tribunal and the Federal Court of Australia have previously denied their application, despite the men's claims of having been stoned, whipped, and ordered killed in a fatwa from their local Islamic council once sexual orientation had become known. A spokesperson for Australia's Immigration Ministry told reporters that homosexuality is, in the government's view, not a valid reason for seeking asylum under the UN Convention on Refugees. With this case, the nation's High Court will take up that question for the first time.
And finally, the prestigious Pulitzer Prizes were awarded this week, including a couple of surprises. Cuban-born Florida playwright Nilo Cruz, who's openly gay according to the venerable gay and lesbian magazine The Advocate, became the first Latino ever to win the Pulitzer for drama. His play, Anna and the Tropics, was only the second ever to win that honor without having been staged in New York City, although the prize makes it a certainty that it will be soon. And few expected that Cruz's work would beat out the other two drama finalists. Richard Greenberg's gay-themed baseball comedy Take Me Out, a success in both New York and London, and legendary gay three-time Pulitzer winner Edward Albee's gay-themed The Goat, or Who is Sylvia?
Still.